What's going on, guys? It's JP from The Double Double, and I'm here with my co-host, Ben.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome.
And today we have a few big picture questions that I've been brewing the last few days and kind of have just come to the forefront on my mind, and I just wanted to discuss them on the podcast with my basketball buddy, Ben, here. So the first thing that kind of came to mind was the Pistons situation right now and how horribly the team's playing. And it kind of just made me think big picture, like, does the Pistons signing Monty Williams to the richest coaching deal in NBA history kind of ruin the idea for other organizations to pay a proven head coach to try to turn around a very bad team? Like, will bad teams ever hire proven coaches again, or will they just stick to hiring G League guys and like lower tier head coaches until they have the talent to prove otherwise?
I mean, what the Pistons did in general, paying Monty Williams as much as they did, I don't think many teams are trying that strategy. Especially, you know, it kind of feels like revisionist history to talk about it this way, but Monty Williams had lost the respect and lost the voice of his own locker room in Phoenix before he went to Detroit. So, you know, if this was a genuine top five coach, if you were somehow able to poach like Eric Spoelstra and bring him to the team and pay him that money, it absolutely would have changed the team. But I think we kind of overvalued how good Monty Williams is at single-handedly saving a franchise.
Right.
Because even if, you know, even if they had an excellent head coach, the Pistons still have an awful roster. So this is one step in a series of steps that Detroit needs to make to become a good team. And, I mean, I think it'll still end up being fine. I think if you put a good roster around, Monty Williams will be a much better coach. But
right.
Thinking that that is just the fix-all, that they'll save their team, that was pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think the Monty Williams contract has reminded everyone that coaches can't suit up and play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, he's getting paid more than some of the players on his team, and he can't put the ball in the hoop, right? He's stuck to the sideline. That is his duty, to get his guys in a position to succeed. And I guess a part of the reason why we're like analyzing this closer than maybe some other coaching jobs in the league is he is making questionable decisions as well. Like,
mm-hmm.
his lineups have been all over the place. He just broke the record for the most losses in a row in NBA history. Like, there is malpractice going on. There is bad head coaching going on. So I guess the real question is just like, is he just a guy that's not worth that contract and potentially overrated as a head coach because of Chris Paul's impact coming to the Suns? Or is this just like, hey, a coach can't turn around a team that has awful talent?
I think it's a big mix of both. I think Monty Williams was not as good of a coach as we probably thought he was. And the fact that the Suns didn't want him anymore and they still want to be a championship contending team, I think that says something. But then you go and look at the roster and, you know, who in this roster is not getting enough minutes? Asar Thompson's got weird games where he only plays the first half, but he's not an offensive player. He's shooting 14.5% from three. You know, so who are you, who should be out there? Isaiah Livers plays more minutes than he deserves. Jaden Ivey doesn't play enough minutes. Killian Hayes got 31 minutes last night in the loss to, I think it was the Kings, in which they were up 18 points in the first quarter.
Yeah.
I think you can blame literally every single member of the Detroit organization except for Cade Cunningham and Jalen Duren. I think those are the only two guys that are pretty blameless, but pretty much everybody else has a lot of room to improve, and that includes Monty Williams.
And I'm in total agreeance. Like, I think it's a shitstorm from start to finish. If you can go back and listen to like our preseason predictions, I thought the Pistons were going to be historically trash. I didn't know this bad, but I thought they were going to be bad. They're worse than I even expected. And it starts from the top. Like, the talent is ass. The GM has been making questionable moves. I've been very critical of Troy Weaver. I actually loved the Monty Williams hire. I thought that was finally a step in the right direction. But now, only after a few months of the NBA season, I'm questioning if he even finishes his contract. Like, is the owner just going to have to pay him $80 million for coaching a year and a half? Like, that's a real question I have. I think this is the perfect example of organizational disarray. And I honestly, you're right. Like, if you're Cade Cunningham, why do you take your rookie extension? Like, why? Why don't you just go into free agency and choose an organization that you know is at least somewhat competent. I don't see a bright future for Detroit. I really don't.
I don't either. And the only thing that's luring him in is the extra, what, $50 million, $40 million that he'll be guaranteed if he stays in Detroit.
Yeah.
That is hard to walk away from, even if you're playing meaningless garbage basketball. You can tell Cade does not want to be in that position, man. A lot of guys are kind of okay with where they are, and they know, like, you know, it's not my fault, the team's awful, whatever, whatever. Cade Cunningham is not one of those guys. You could tell in that losing streak, every single game, it was getting to him more and more. Maybe he doesn't accept the rookie extension. Maybe he finds his own place somewhere else. I would love to see it, honestly.
And it's weird with Cade, especially, like, he is a born winner. Like, this dude was on the greatest high school team in history, and he took an Oklahoma State team with no other players that got drafted and made them relevant, and then he gets put on this absolute shit show team. And some of this is bad luck in the lottery, right? Like, if they got Wembanyama instead of Asar Thompson, things could probably look way different right now, but you have to play with the cards you've been dealt, and they've just done about as poor as a job as humanly possible. So just the big picture with the Pistons and just the idea of, like, can a coach be a savior really kind of came to the forefront of my mind recently with how bad they've been.
Yeah, and Monty Williams, certainly not the savior. I think there's a handful of coaches out there. We talk about how many top three coaches exist in the league. If you put any one of them on the Pistons, we'd be getting a better product, but they'd still probably be last in the East.
Right, and that's kind of what I wanted to kind of close the conversation with is, you know, even with Eric Spoelstra as the head coach for the Pistons, I think maybe we see better defensive instinct. I think maybe better defensive IQ throughout the whole roster, maybe better shot selection. But generally, this team would still be fucking horrible. And yes. I think that all comes back to one man, which is Troy Weaver. I'm not so sure he should have his job right now, never mind by the end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, that team, if you had Spoelstra as a coach, would still have Killian Hayes, Alec Burks, James Wiseman, Marvin Bagley, Isaiah Livers on it. Joe Harris, who's not playing. That's a lot of players who are not contributing to winning in any sense. So, you know, where would Spo get talent from? We know that he's the kind of dude who can do that. Maybe some of these guys would play better under his coaching. But it's not like they'd become great NBA players, and they wouldn't change the Pistons.
Right. So overall, I just think if you're Cade, I would love to see him kind of do something extremely unprecedented and force his way to a situation that can actually nurture his talent. And I'm sorry for Pistons fans, because I do not see a light at the end of the tunnel for you guys. Like, this looks like a 10-year slog to me.
Yeah. I mean, if Cade sticks around and Jalen Duren sticks around and Asar Thompson improves a little bit offensively and they're able to sign 9 new basketball players who are not on this team, then right. The Pistons could become something else.
Right. So let's move on to another topic that's come to the forefront of my mind as of late. Do bad losses make you a fake contender? And I kind of want to just give you some context for this specific question. The Bucks have lost a lot of weird, bad games this year, giving up 140 points to teams that definitely aren't that talented. And they are the second seed in the East. They're viewed as the third favorite in the entire league to win the title, but they lose games to teams they shouldn't lose to. Damian Lillard disappears in games that should be easy for him to succeed. Giannis can't do everything on his own. We've seen that a few times this year where he'll put up 48 points and 17 rebounds and they'll lose the game as a team. So it kind of makes me question, if this is a team that's losing games against teams that aren't talented during the regular season, what gives us the confidence in them heading into the postseason to be a legitimate contender?
That's a great question. And honestly, I mean, I think you can look at some championship teams from the past. Denver Nuggets last year, Jokic lost his MVP race simply because he gave up in the last couple weeks of the season. They had an ugly loss to the Spurs and then followed it up with an ugly loss to another bad Western Conference team. And you could tell they were just kind of thrown in the towel with no effort. Yeah. Now, to me, that's a bad loss, but it's different than what we're seeing in Milwaukee because it's early in the season and Milwaukee wants these wins. They did not want to lose 4 times to Indiana. They did not want to lose twice to Chicago. So these losses are bad, and I think it just shows the glaring problem that everybody knows exists in Milwaukee, which is that nobody on this team can guard anybody. Giannis is a great, great, unbelievable defender, and he's alone on a team full of guys who do not know how to play defense.
You're right. Like, this weakness of theirs has been exposed throughout the season, right? And that's kind of what made this come into my mind, because the other night they lost to the Rockets and they lost to the Utah Jazz by 16. And I am just thinking to myself, how many teams struggle to score on the Bucks? And the answer is none of them. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets their own against the Bucks. The Pacers routinely put up over 120 on them. San Antonio put up 120 on them the other day. Like I said, the Jazz 132 on the Bucks. Like, this is a pitiful, pitiful defense. But I think we all tell ourselves, oh, they'll be in the picture, you know, at the end of the year. We saw it with the Celtics last year. That was the team that kind of came to mind with these bad losses. His last year, everyone kept saying during the regular season, like, why do they keep losing to these ass teams? And everyone just kind of quieted that talk because they were beating the good teams during the regular season. And, oh, they'll be fine in the postseason. Well, how did it work out? Not very well for the Celtics. They got down 3-0 to Miami, who was an 8 seed, and got embarrassed. I don't care that it got to a 7-game series. That's an embarrassing postseason run for them when your expectation is a title. My alarms are going off for Milwaukee right now, and I'm kind of considering them a fake contender as far as I'm concerned.
I think the Celtics are a good team to look at in terms of this sort of thing because, you know, my thought process has always been you don't play the ass teams in the playoffs, so the fact that you're losing games to Washington or to OKC before they were good or teams like that, like, you're never going to see them in the playoffs. Who cares that you're not getting enough for them, you're not putting in enough effort? The issue with the Bucks is it's not an effort thing. The Celtics in those games just didn't feel like showing up to play basketball. The Bucks are trying. They just don't have anybody who can guard anybody. Right. So, you know, there was a solution there for the Celtics where it was just like, guys, try harder. Like, these games matter. Stop doing this. But, like, there's no easy solution that I see for Milwaukee to just get over their defensive woes.
And I've watched a few Milwaukee games in the past week to kind of figure this out on my own. And something I've been confused by is their half-court defense doesn't look atrocious to me. Like, I'm not visibly seeing lack of effort and bad rotations and bad contests and stuff like that. But God forbid a transition leak out happens. There's not a single player trying to stop it. A single one. And I don't know if that's due to the age of the team, where guys just don't feel like running back. I don't know if it's literally they don't know how to stop a fast break or a semi-fast break, or if that's Adrian Griffin's job. Like, I don't know what's happening there in Milwaukee, but these bad losses are starting to pile up pretty early on in the season, and this is informing how I think about them as a playoff team, despite them being the second seed in the East.
It's the inability to force turnovers that's really killing them. They're 29th in terms of turnovers forced on defense, and they're 30th in terms of shot attempts taken against them. So teams shoot more against the Bucks than any other team in the league because they don't lose the ball. It's very easy to get to their positions. It's very easy to run the offense they want to run. Because when you look at the lineup, man, Damian Lillard, Malik Beasley, Jay Crowder, Chris Middleton, Pat Connaughton, none of those guys are defending. You know, so your point of attack defense, when that's garbage and all you really have is Giannis and Brooke Lopez, please do whatever you can to protect the hoop. It doesn't work. It's not a real strategy.
And Bucks fans are probably saying right now, well, oh, Jay Crowder's been hurt. Just wait until he comes back and Malik Beasley goes back on the bench. Malik Beasley is a huge reason why this offense is like the second best offense in the league right now, because he's shooting like 47% from the corners. Like, he's hitting every 1 out of 2 threes, it feels like.
He's shooting 48% from three right now on 6 attempts a game.
Like, that is just freakish shooting. It's insane what he's doing right now. So, you get Jay Crowder to take his spot in the starting lineup. Now is your offense as good as it is? You know what I mean? There are just issues embedded in this team that I'm not sure will sustain a long championship run.
And if we're talking about coaches that run the risk of being fired halfway through a season, their opening season, Adrian Griffin might be that dude. I think if the Bucks knew they were going to get Damian Lillard, Mike Budenholzer wouldn't have gone anywhere. He is absolutely not a playoff elevating team, but you don't need that when you've got the amount of talent they have. You just need a guy who knows how to steady the ship. Adrian Griffin's not that guy.
I think that's a very fair point. I think I made the argument a bunch of times on our podcast that I think the Bucks would have won the championship last year if Giannis didn't hurt his back 9 minutes into game one against the Heat. So saying Mike Budenholzer was the problem is a little bit ridiculous. And honestly, looking back, it's like, yes, Budenholzer really struggled to make adjustments, but that man won a coach of the year as their coach and an NBA championship as their head coach because he knew how to play certain cards with that team. I think the Bucks and Adrian Griffin are in for a very weird season, and I just don't view them as a legitimate contender despite their record. I don't know if you feel the same.
I mean, we're saying all of that, and they're still number two in the East, up by two wins over Philly for third. So yeah. Through all these bad games, through the four losses in five games and barely squeaking out a win against San Antonio, they're still second in the East. And yeah. They're still, you know, the games that they win, I think they've had eight games that they've won by over 12 points. So they do beat teams up when things are going well. But in those games where Damian Lillard is not nuclear, which has been honestly most of them, he has not been an unbelievable all-NBA first-team caliber guy the way he's been in the past. Do you think there's a chance that he gets to that?
I don't know. And it's, I mean, if you're a Bucks fan, you are disappointed in Damian Lillard. You just are. Yes, he's scoring 25 points per game. It's on 43% from the floor and 35% from three. This is a guy that had the career. He had a career year just last year where he's scoring 32 points per game on 46% from the floor and 37% from three. So he drops by 3 and 2 percentage points in the efficiency categories, and he's in a better situation. Like, now you're starting to think, oh boy, you know, next year, is Dame still an elite player, or is he at the age where now every year he's in the league, he's going to get slightly worse? And if you're Milwaukee and you just paid a price to get him that was pretty hefty, you're going to be nervous. Like, I think Milwaukee's in a very interesting position as a franchise right now.
Especially when there's no youth anywhere else on the team.
Right.
You know, there's not a young guy who's going to stick around this team for the future. We're going to have a difficult conversation to make very soon about getting rid of Brook Lopez and Chris Middleton and maybe Bobby Portis, but he's 28. Right. All these guys are just getting older. Jay Crowder's 33. This team, as it stands, as it's currently constructed, if this isn't a year where they look like a dominant playoff team, I think we're going to get into the offseason and shit's going to change.
Totally agree. I don't know if you have anything else to say on the Bucks. We can move on to the next one. Something else that's been kind of sitting in my mind is, can teams with elite defenses and poor offenses actually win a title? And this was all sparked by me watching the Timberwolves versus the Mavericks the other night, where the Mavericks are a hyper-offensive team, and the Minnesota Timberwolves are a hyper-defensive team. And during the stretch of the game, one team had Luka, and he was banging home shots left and right. And then the Mavericks double-teamed Anthony Edwards and said, someone else has to do something. And it happened to be two Rudy Gobert turnovers that sealed the game. Rudy is a horrible offensive player. I think he is going to win Defensive Player of the Year this year. That doesn't change that. But as an offensive player, he is horrible. And when teams' entire identity is we're going to stop the other team, what about the players that can't be stopped, right? The Giannis's, the Jokic's, the Kevin Durant's, the, you know, maybe SGA's when he gets there. What happens to those teams when they face those caliber of players?
It's a great question. The thing that I feel like is Anthony Edwards is in that list of guys that you cannot stop.
Yeah.
So, you know, the numbers, the offensive rating right now for the Minnesota Timberwolves, they're 19th in the NBA. And I think you can even look at Miami Heat from last year and from the years before. I don't know if they were ever a top 10 offense and defense, even top 10 offense or defense. The past couple of seasons, they're kind of just middle of the pack through the regular season. And then once the playoffs start, shit changes. I think the Minnesota offense, when the playoffs start, is built entirely around Anthony Edwards win us these games. We saw it when they played Denver, and he was incredible. So if the offense can be effective around him, I think that's kind of what it all comes down to. The defense is going to be there game after game, but if they can shut him down with just a double team and make Cat and everybody else beat you, the Timberwolves are not making it to the finals.
Yeah, and I think it made me realize something about the Timberwolves, whereas if any other player has a bad game next to Ant, like they don't reach their normal production, they lose. Mm-hmm. Like Jaden McDaniels that game, I think, went 1-for-10 from the floor. That lost them the game. They needed him to at least hit a few more shots. And Cat had an awesome game. And Rudy's obviously not an offensive player, so when the ball touched his hands, bad things happened. And it also made me pivot to the Lakers, right, where they are a dominant defense and the worst three-point shooting team in the entire league. And is that sustainable? Because their objective is to choke you out and make you score 92 points. But unfortunately, they can't hit that 92 points very often. They're at 500. They're a 500 ball club right now. You know, can they win a title if things don't change for them? Like, you know what I mean? It's just, can defense win championships anymore? Or are you supposed to be hyper offensive?
I think you need to not be terrible offensively. I think if you are a middling offense, if you're okay and you're an excellent defense, that's what the Timberwolves are to me. The Lakers, to me, are an awesome defense and one of the worst offenses in basketball. Even in these games where AD and LeBron combine for over 60 points, they lose. They lose comfortably because nobody else on the team really has the offensive chops to carry them to a win like that. I don't think the Lakers are at all a title contending team. I think they would need to make some pretty big moves to become that. I do think the Timberwolves are the team that should be the Western Conference Finals champion.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think Minnesota's going to make the WCF. I think the Nuggets are still the team in the West. Obviously, I know you do as well. But, you know, it is pretty interesting to see how these teams are operating, because the Nuggets, they were a hyper-offensive team and then found their defensive groove in the playoffs and became an elite defense. Can a team do the inverse, right? Can Minnesota all of a sudden just figure out their offense when it comes playoff time, like the Nuggets figured out their defense? So that's just something I'm going to be looking out for Minnesota. And in terms of what you said with the Lakers, you know, this has to do with the trade deadline a little bit, but does Zach LaVine add enough offensive punch to that team where it becomes, okay, you're one of the worst offenses in the league, and now because of his spacing and athleticism, you become a top half of the league offense just from his addition alone?
It's a great question, man. I think it's very possible. I think it's very possible. Anthony Davis is the kind of guy who by himself can be a top five defense in this league. Yeah. So if you have to give up some defensive pieces, but you get a true offensive star. You know, Zach LaVine, I have definitely been lower on than a lot of people. I don't know that I believe in him as like a team elevator, but when you have LeBron and Anthony Davis, those are the team elevators and you need competent scorers. Zach LaVine can go out and get you 25 pretty much every night.
Yeah, and everyone's poo-pooing Zach LaVine in the media right now, and that's fine, but I do think there has to be some recognition that this guy went like 11 for 13 from three and scored 50 points multiple times in the last year or so. So this isn't like some Joe Schmo. This guy is like an elite shot creator. Does he do a lot else? No, but guess what the Lakers need? Elite shot creation. So it does seem like a really good fit. So those two teams are definitely on my mind, which is how they play hoops and what if that can bring them a championship.
I agree. I'll let you pivot here to the next question. I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, so is Miami proving that organizational competence is just as important as star players? Because me and you texted a little bit the other day. They've had 19 different lineups this year, and they're still a playoff team. And it's just Pat Riley continuing to bring in new players and Eric Spoelstra continuing to probably be the best head coach in the NBA. And it just seems like they are the steadiest ship in the entire league. Nothing can faze them. I just think, you know, other teams are so focused on getting stars and stuff. Maybe you reverse engineer it and make sure you just get an unbelievable GM and head coach.
Maybe Eric Spoelstra is legitimately one of one. Maybe that's what it is. Really? Maybe there's not another coach in the NBA who could do what he can do with the kind of rosters that he's given. I think there's a reason that the Miami Heat went after a guy like Jaime Jaquez, and it was because they knew this is a guy who's ready to go right now. This is not a guy who we expect to be a star. This is not a guy we expect to be the first, second, third, fourth offensive weapon on the team. This is just a guy who knows his shit and is going to show up and play the right form of basketball day in and day out. When you're the Miami Heat, when you go and get guys like that, of course your situation looks awesome. The fact that they were able to win with the injuries that they've had, Jimmy Butler's played 24 games, Tyler Hero's played 18, Bam's played 26, and they're still fifth in the East right now, 21-15. It is a testament to the coach. It is a testament to the fact that these guys all understand, you know, whoever's missing, they have an understanding of who picks up the slack and who doesn't. Everybody is perfectly in sync. And yeah, that does come down to the guys at the top.
And this is like, what I think is interesting too, is I think they have kind of hamstrung themselves with some of their contracts. Like, I think the Kyle Lowry deal was one of the worst deals of the last half decade.
Sure.
The Tyler Hero extension, like, it looked fine at the time. This guy's getting paid $35 million a year. Like, that's a lot of money for someone who does what he does. I just, you know, some of these contracts and decision-making that they've been a part of have been questionable, but everything always works out in the end for them. And it's a really, really interesting like case study where you're right. Eric Spoelstra might just be one of one, and that's why they're in this situation. And you could probably say the same thing for Pat Riley, where he's a Hall of Fame level head coach, a Hall of Fame GM, and a Hall of Fame executive all in one. You know, that is a rare combination to have. I just think they, you know, Heat culture is so corny and I hate how much we have to say it, but at the same time, they do have some validity in, you know, kind of making that mantra.
Yes, it's absolutely corny. I think that needs to be said. They talk about Heat culture more than anybody else in the world. But when year after year they continue to do this shit, you got to tip your cap. I think for 4 years in a row, I have started the season saying the Miami Heat are trash. This is the last year. They're not going to be good anymore. And then they continue to just do it. Duncan Robinson last year played no minutes, 16 minutes a game, half the season. They shut him out and they were paying him $19 million. It didn't matter for anything because they had guys like Strus and Gabe Vincent who could just pick up the slack. The fact that they just, I don't know, it feels like they never misuse players.
Right.
I heard a conversation about, you know, like if Miami Heat's letting a player go, do not pick them up. if it's a situation like Max Strus where they couldn't afford to pay him, you know that guy's worth something. But like Omer Yurtseven was a dude who was putting up 15 and 15s for them. He got waived. He's not a guy you go pick up because he's only doing that for Miami.
Right. Yeah, it's really, really weird. And I think like as you who are a fan of the Boston Celtics, who are the king of the East right now, like, who are you more afraid to play, Miami or Philly or Miami or Milwaukee, right? Like, these are actual conversations you have to have, even though Philly and Milwaukee are the 2 and 3 seeds. Just because we trust Miami and they've shown us that they have the competence and, like, stability to show up when it matters, like, you actually have to be afraid of them despite the Celtics being a historically good team this year.
Yeah, I mean, after what we watched from the Heat against the Celtics last year, Caleb Martin and the masterclass that he was putting together, man, of course, I'm terrified of the Heat.
Right. And now, like you mentioned, last year, Duncan Robinson's ass was pinned to the bench, and now he's having a career year. So just one offseason in between, he had one of the worst years of his career and now a career year. He's playmaking better than he ever has. Cutting is his specialty. And these the shots he hits from 3-point land are just so stupid. And that is the type of guy that they can unlock in a playoff series and just completely topple a team like the Celtics who will be heavily favored heading into that series.
They have 8 guys averaging 3 assists a game.
Yeah.
Like that is, it's crazy the way that they play and the way that everybody gets involved. Of course they are a scary ass team and it's not, it comes down to the guys at the top. Absolutely. Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra are the ones who instill the most fear out of anybody in Miami.
Right. Let's move on to another one. Is there value in making a trade to stay in the mix, even though it may not make you a contender? This question kind of came to mind with the OG Anunoby to the Knicks trade. And also the Pascal Siakam trade chatter to the Sacramento Kings. Because I view both of those trades as upgrades, but they definitely don't launch either of those teams into title contention. So just from your perspective, like, break that down for me, and what is the value in doing something like that? Or do you think that's a bad move to make a trade like that?
I mean, if you're a team that has glaring issues that you need to improve on, you should be taking steps to make those improvements. Even if they don't make you the best team in the East or the best team in the league, the New York Knicks needed a really strong wing defender. And honestly, a guy like RJ needs the ball in his hands more than OG, and that's a problem. You've got Jalen Brunson and Julius Randle. So this is a situation where I think it worked out perfectly for both teams. Quickly to the Raptors, I think having that quick-ass point guard and quickly is awesome for them. RJ Barrett has been great for Toronto. That was a win-win trade to me. I think it made both teams better, and I think it fit both situations better. And personally, if I was a GM, I'd be trying to make moves like that all day. That is how you become... It's how you propel yourself towards contender status, is by making those right moves and actually understanding what your team needs and going out and getting it done.
Right. And I think, you know, the Knicks are undefeated since grabbing OG. They beat Minnesota in his debut. They beat Chicago by 16. They beat Philly by 30. They beat Washington by 16. And then they beat Portland by 30.
And OG's plus minus is 111, plus 111 through five games.
Right. And it, to me, like, it makes me take the Knicks way more seriously, right? Like, this is a team where they've clearly gotten better. They're definitely more versatile on defense now, especially with a defensive head coach like Thibodeau, getting a guy like OG who can guard literally 1 through 5. I know we say that for a lot of players. For him, it's legitimate. Go check his defensive statistics. He's on all five positions around the same amount of time. You know, when you face a team like the Celtics, having a guy that can clamp Jason Tatum over a series is going to be helpful. Or if you face the 76ers, having a guy that can kind of bully Tyrese Maxey a little bit with his size and length, that's going to matter. So even though I don't think it propels them into contendership, I do think that move makes me respect the Knicks as an organization a little bit more. So I'm a big fan of it, but I think there may be some people that just kind of like disregard the move altogether because it doesn't put them in the title picture.
Yeah, I think that's kind of lame. You know, only one team wins the title every year. Only two teams come close. So, you know, for the other 28 teams who are not in the finals year after year, you got to be a good product. You got to be taking the right steps. For me, for New York, this was absolutely taking the right step. You know, we hear so much talk about how the New York Knicks want to grab every single all-star guard in existence.
Yeah.
And how they're right on the cusp of, you know, Donovan Mitchell and Tyler Hero and every name you can think of. Doing something like this where you just get a guy who fits your team, does what you need him to do. He's not a flashy guy, but he's exactly what the team wants. I think it's a perfect trade. Siakam to the Kings is an interesting one.
Yeah. So what would you think about that fit? Where it is a similar type deal where the Kings are a middling team in the Western Conference, like they're going to be in the playoff picture, but no one's putting them in the contendership. They add a guy like Pascal Siakam, who gives them a pseudo big three, right? De'Aaron Fox, Sabonis, and Siakam have all made all NBA teams before. You know, what does that do for them? Like, would you encourage a move like that for them to kind of push them forward?
I think it's a great question. Honestly, some of the losses that Sacramento has put up this year have been pathetic. The 33-point loss to the Pelicans the other day, De'Aaron Fox had, what, 3 points? Let me go back and look. Yeah, 3 points on 1 of 10 from the field. Their strategy, the Pel's strategy, was just, we're forcing the ball out of De'Aaron Fox's hands. Everybody else is going to beat us. And they couldn't. Yeah. So if you bring in Pascal Siakam to your team, that is a guy who, when De'Aaron Fox is getting clamped, somebody else is going to beat you. Pascal can put up 35 in a game pretty easily.
Right.
What do you have to get rid of to get him, though, is I think the question. And that's why the Knicks trade was so perfect, was you traded a guy in RJ Barrett who wasn't really even a perfect fit for your team. Losing quickly was tough, but you traded a guy who didn't fit your team for a guy who did fit your team really well. I don't know what that looks like in Sacramento.
So the reported trade package was Harrison Barnes, Kevin Huerter, Davion Mitchell, and an unprotected first round pick. as far as I'm concerned, that seems okay to me. Pascal's an expiring contract. He's a free agent after this season. So, like, Toronto could lose him for nothing. If you get a what's supposed to be an elite shooter, I know Herter's having a down year right now, and Harrison Barnes, like, I don't know. That seems pretty good with Davion Mitchell as just another guard that they desperately need out there in Toronto. I don't know. I wasn't opposed to it. I thought it made both teams better, and I thought it made sense for both of their timelines. So I wish the trade went through. It's, I guess Toronto hated the offer. Maybe they wanted Keegan Murray, which I don't think is possible for them. But if you put Siakam on that team, like, they're much better defensively. They're much more creative offensively. I think he would be a perfect fit for the Sacramento Kings. And then we have to start throwing them in conversations where it's like, could they make the Western Conference final if, you know, De'Aaron Fox has an unbelievable series? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and he was a baller in that series against Golden State. So there's reason to believe he could be that. To right. me, though, that sounds like a bag of beans plus a first-round pick for Pascal okay. Siakam. You know, Kevin Herter had a great season last year directly as a result of De'Aaron Fox and Sabonis. He's not a guy who's an awesome player in his own right. He's a guy who needs those setup guys.
Yeah.
You know, Harrison Barnes is not anything. If you could replace Harrison Barnes for Pascal Siakam one for one, and you'd have to lose a couple role players, that's unbelievable for the Kings.
Yeah.
I don't know what it would take, though. I don't know if they've got the draft assets to go in more. I think that's probably the direction Toronto would want. If I was Sacramento, right now I love where the Kings are at. If you could mortgage a little bit of your future, give up more first-round picks, and get Siakam to your team, I would be pulling that trigger.
I'm right there with you. I don't think it's time to start slowing things down with Sacramento. I think you're already better than you have been in over 2 decades. Continue this trend. Get another established player in the building in Pascal Siakam. Pay him what he wants to be paid. And try to contend for a championship. You never know who's going to get hurt. You never know who's going to choke in the playoffs. Like, things will open up potentially. And I think, you know, if they can get that deal done, definitely get that deal done if you're Sacramento.
Yeah, man. I mean, I feel like, you know, as a fan of the NBA, I don't think enough trades are made year after year. I think we come up with a lot of them. We haven't done our trade episode yet this year, but we come up with a lot of them. And, you know, maybe I'm a bit biased, but they'd improve the teams we're talking about, man. I think every team should be doing what the New York Knicks did and say, you know, these are the steps we could take to get better. Sure, people are going to be mad at me because I traded their favorite guy. Whatever. We want the team to be better. That's my goal.
And a lot of people have killed the Chicago Bulls for the Vucevic trade. I was a fan of that in the moment because it showed intention to want to contend.
Yes.
They were done being a horrible team. They wanted to prove that they meant something in the league, and it worked when Lonzo Ball was healthy. Like, I think the revisionist history of this is a little annoying because when he was on that team, they were a legitimately good team. And same thing with the Sabonis-Haliburton trade. Like, the Kings got killed for that. I was one of the people who killed them for that, and so were you. We hopped on that podcast calling that organization idiots.
Yeah.
Guess what? Now they're in the playoff mix for the second year in a row, and if they make another move at the trade deadline, we have to put them in a pseudo contender tier. This was a team that was at the bottom of the league for 2 decades, right? So, you know, trades that don't put you in the title picture but help your franchise move forward, I'm always going to be a fan of. And you're right, dude. Like, we make 100 of these trades a year, it feels like. I'm eyeballing Orlando right now with Luke Kennard and Buddy Hield on the trade market. Like, go get both of them.
Yeah, because we know at the end of the season, the three-point shooting is going to be an issue for Orlando. They know. Exactly. Anybody who covers the Orlando Magic or basketball knows it. So why aren't they taking steps to fix that? I mean, we ask ourselves that constantly.
Yeah. But so I'm glad we're in alignment there with teams making deals to get better, but maybe not just to win a title, but to literally just be a better product on the floor and give yourself a puncher's chance to make it to a finals or win a championship. Last thing here, this one's a little bit of a bummer. I hate talking about this shit because it kind of reminds me of like boohoo unfair type behavior that you see in like youth sports. But I feel like I've heard more of a conversation about it this year than maybe ever before. And it's the officiating in the NBA. And you brought up a really good point pre-show which is now with the NBA pushing gambling to the extent that it does, where they're updating you on live lines during nationally televised games every single day, the officiating and how poor it's been and some of the mistakes that have been made are now like affecting people's pockets. And it seems like there's maybe more of an outrage this year than there has been in before. So I guess the question I have for you is just, how do we fix it? Is it fixable? Like, should we just ignore it? You know, human error is a part of the game. Like, what are your views on just all of this bullshit?
Human error is absolutely a part of refereeing. Absolutely. They're going to make mistakes, not on purpose, that affect the result of a game because they miss something. But I think the issue that we're seeing is a lot of refs who are trying to be an 11th man on the floor, who are trying to be like, I want my moment in the sunshine. Everybody look at me. Look at the calls I'm making. Like, it's not a coincidence that Chris Paul loses every game that Scott Foster referees. It's not a coincidence. You look at, you know, I don't want to make this into how dare the Celtics not get that win against the Pacers the other night, because, like, that's not the only example of bad refereeing this year.
Right.
The Toronto Raptors coach just went off on how awful they were, how awful the refs were against the Lakers last night. 23 free throws to the Raptors 2 in the fourth quarter alone, for a team that drives to the hoop a lot. They should have gotten more foul calls. And you go back and look, and it's hard to not watch these games and think, like, that missed call was intentional. Like, there, it's hard to not think that when I watch these games.
Yeah, and it's weird. There has been poor officiating. Usually, I try not to care during the game. But when these calls are happening in, like, crunch time situations, or when you're seeing, like, a clear and obvious advantage to one team over the other... For me, it was the Lakers-Raptors game that was obviously highlighted. I didn't get to watch that Celtics-Pacers game, but I heard about it everywhere, and how egregious some of the calls were. But the Raptors having two free throw attempts in the fourth quarter, when they're a team that can't shoot outside shots and they constantly get to the bucket, and then the Lakers getting 23 and being rewarded for flops and all this bullshit, like... It does make you think, like, fuck, you know, why did the Raptors show up to the arena? Which is why, which is what the Raptors head coach said after the game, where it's like, you know, if the fix is in, like, you know, if the Lakers need to win this game, like, can we just not participate and you just give them a win?
Right.
Why are we involved? Usually I don't pay attention to refereeing almost at all. Even in the middle of games when I see bad calls, it's just like, in my head, I tell myself that they'll reward the other team down down the other side of the game at some point just to make up for it, which I feel like they usually do. But sometimes, like, ooh, it looks tough. So, my idea for a fix would probably just be no last 2-minute report come out anymore, because I think it just adds fuel to the fucking trash fire that happens on Twitter, where people retweet it and say, look at these bum ass refs, get them fired, you know, take their jobs. They should never see a basketball court again. For me, I'm kind of just of the ilk of being like, it's human error. Get used to it, guys. But this year, it does seem like I've heard more of it than usual.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the refs are never going to be 100% perfect. I am kind of the mindset that some of these misses are intentional. Some of these decision making are intentional. It's not like we didn't have Tim Donaghy as a referee clearly involved in fixing games. It's not like Scott Foster wasn't a referee at the same time and was very close with Tim Donaghy. You can go back to 2002, the Lakers-Kings series. Of course, that was rigged. I think so.
Yeah.
There has always been a sense that, like, some of these referees have some agendas that are beyond the game that's going on right now.
Absolutely.
And my personal thing, the last 2-minute report, that needs to be done by an independent group. That cannot be done by the same referees who are making the call on the floor, not by the same group. Because when you go back and say, you know, sometimes it just feels like fan service. Sometimes it just feels like, oh, guys, you could have had that one. Oh, but we messed up. Sorry about that. But it's just a meaningless statement that doesn't impact the standings at all. Referees don't get punished for making mistakes, and I don't know how we do that. Like, if a guy makes an accidental miscall and you fine him for that, I don't think that's right. But there's got to be some sort of auditing done to look at these games and decide, like, are refs kind of deciding more shit than they should be? Because that's what I feel.
Yeah, and I feel like in spot moments in nationally televised games, we're seeing this, right? Where it's like in fourth quarters, we're like, fuck, did they just win the Pacers the game? And then the last 2 minute report comes out to confirm that, yeah, we kind of did.
Yeah.
And then the Lakers game, same shit, where it's like, oh, like, they are deciding the game, not the players tonight. That shit is weird. But at the same time, I go back to thinking, like, the NBA, they're hiring the best of the best for this shit. And I know it might not sound like that or feel like that, but who is going to be better than the people already there? Like, are we going to pull people up from high school basketball and go tell them to referee LeBron appropriately? Like, I don't really know what the solution is. Like, a part of me thinks, like, Twitter needs to, like, suck on a binky and just get over it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how much we can control it. Now, if there's, like, illegal activity going on where games are being fixed, obviously that needs to be eradicated. But there's no proof of that yet. And, you know, the Scott Foster shit, I'm with you. Like, I don't know how that's been dealt with or, like, continued. I don't know why that's been allowed in any regard, where Chris Paul literally cannot win a fucking basketball game if Scott Foster's in charge. That is not coincidence.
And it's beyond basketball. Like, Scott Foster's, yeah, we've been on record, he's saying shit to Chris Paul's kids. Like, he's yelling, yeah, at their kid. Like, it's beyond basketball.
Right. So, officiating, I almost never want to talk about it. I thought it was worth bringing up, though, especially with the last two games we've seen in the last few days with the Celtics, Pacers, and Raptors, Lakers.
Yeah.
But in terms of a solution, like, I'm kind of at a loss for words. I don't really have a good one. I thought that's why I'd bring it up to you, to see if you might have one.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. What do we do about it? I'm not going to pretend like the Celtics are hated by the NBA or like there's an agenda to make them lose. I remember last season against the Lakers, a awful, bogus no call. The Tatum fouled LeBron, wasn't called. Celtics won the game. I remember, yep, that. You know, these agendas exist in all these games, and it's probably not like a buddy of mine's got $1,000 on the Pacers. I got to give him this call. But it's definitely like there's some emotion going on behind the scenes into why these refs make the calls that they do and why they hold their whistle. What do we do about it, though? How do we audit these guys? How do we make them accountable for their mistakes without like making them scared to make the right call? You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, last year, the big thing was the Fred Van Vliet versus whatever ref that was. I don't know if you remember that exchange where Fred Van Vliet only has like 3 technicals in his entire career and they all came from the same referee. And he was just like during one press conference, he just lost it on this referee and he got mandated for it. Like, right, the referee was not allowed to referee Fred Van Vliet's games for a few months. Why aren't we seeing that a little bit more? You know, if we do see bias towards a player, like, I don't know. I don't really know. This is all way too complicated for me to even begin to think of a solution. And I don't know how the NBA will think of one or if they even view it as a problem to begin with. Like, I don't know if the NBA cares as much as we do. But yeah, I thought it was important to address at least for a little bit on the pod.
Yeah, I mean, There's not a lot of value in being a ridiculous conspiracy theorist about like why the refs are doing what they're doing, whether or not, yeah, I believe that they're throwing games for money or for fame, whatever the reason. I definitely feel like they're influencing games on purpose, but the reason, I have no idea. But the solution has to be, I don't know, man, does Adam Silver even care? That's a good question. Does Adam Silver even view this as a problem that needs immediate fixing? I don't really think so.
So I don't know if you have anything else more to say about officiating. I'm already tired of it. but I think that'll wrap everything up unless you thought of anything else you'd like to get out there, or are you all set for today?
I think I want to have one question that we brought up a while ago off pod and we just never got the chance to fully talk about on the podcast. I want to talk about the Thunder a little bit.
Okay.
And I want to talk about, like, you know, do they need to go out and do more? Do they need to go out and get more? When I watched them beat the Celtics the other night, That was an unbelievable team win. And yeah. just the way that they're able to stop guys in half-court defense, their rebounding isn't excellent, but when you could just shut down possession after possession like that, like, what do you feel in terms of the Thunder and whether or not they should be trying to make moves to improve, or should they just keep the unit they have?
It's actually really funny you brought this up, because one of the questions I was going to write is, how long are championship windows actually? Because I think we saw with the Celtics, they've been competing since 2018. We're now in 2024. Their championship window has been 6 years. They just haven't capitalized on it. So for OKC, this is the first year you've been great. Do you handle it like the Celtics and just say, hey, we've grown this organically, let's just keep chugging along and we'll make, you know, trades along the edges to kind of build an infrastructure for our team over a long period of time? Or do you say, hey, you never know when this shit's going to end, let's try to cash in all of our chips right now and win a championship? I don't really know the answer to it, because you can make a case that, you know, SGA is OKC's version of Tatum. Chet is OKC's version of Jaylen Brown. And like Jalen Williams is OKC's version of whoever on the Celtics, right? Like they have three players on their team that they're confident in for the next 5 to 6 years. So I have no idea. I think I might try to play it organically and make next season, because I view the Celtics and the Nuggets as juggernauts to the point where I only see those two facing each other in the finals this year. I don't really see anyone else even trying to crack that. But maybe next year is the year they capitalize, where maybe the Celtics get a little bit worse, their whole team's getting older, you know, their contracts get super expensive, or Michael Porter Jr. gets hurt next year, you know, something like that, right? I guess that's how I would handle it, but what about you?
The way that I feel about this team, honestly, is with all of the youth and this whole roster top to bottom, these guys only have room to grow. Jalen Williams is doing some awesome shit this year as just a self-creator that I didn't fully see from him his rookie year, especially when it comes to the three-point shooting. Like, this kid's only got room to grow. Chet Holmgren is already one of the most exciting centers in the league. He's only got room to grow. These guys are so young. I do feel like just keep the unit you have and see what you could become. Like, yeah. There's not... the second you start throwing a $35 million contract at a dude to bring a star onto your team that's already got all this talent, it messes with the dynamic. Yeah. And I think they kind of get the pecking order. Shea is their guy. Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren are their number two and three scorers. And then everybody else kind of picks up the scrap. Until we see glaring weaknesses, especially with, like, if the rebounding really kills them when the playoffs start, then I'm going to feel like the Thunder have to improve. But what just how good their half-court offense and defense is, it's hard for me to be that worried.
I'm kind of there with you, because for me, the only spot I see them needing to improve is backup center. That's it. As far as this year's concerned and them wanting to, like, prove themselves in the postseason, I think if they had a heavier, bulkier center that they could switch out with Chet if he got in foul trouble, I think that would be extremely valuable to them. But outside of that, like, I really do think this team's almost perfectly built.
Yeah, man. And they're such a uniquely built team. Like, they don't have high volume 3-point shooters besides Isaiah Joe, who's their seventh man in terms of minutes played. This is right. just a team that beats you up in the paint and then makes it very difficult to get any of your sets off offensively. Yeah, you right. might be able to get in with some offensive rebounds and get second chance points. They do let up a lot of second chance points. But if they yep. can stop you and get that board, man, like, just the defense gets so stifling at times.
Yeah, and they're a team that this year, it's going to be their first legitimate run in the postseason. There is going to be a team that's bigger and stronger than them and embarrass them.
That's Minnesota. If, yeah, you know, if it's a matchup against Minnesota, I feel like we can't go into the offseason with any big picture thoughts just because of how big the T-Wolves are.
Right, and or the Lakers, right, where Rui Hachimura, LeBron James, and Anthony Davis are all on the court at the same time. All of those dudes are 6'10 or bigger, right? So it's like that's just going to be a problem for OKC to deal with. And then you also have the Nuggets, where it's Aaron Gordon and Jokic just pounding inside. You know, that's going to be an issue for them as well. So I respect the hell out of OKC. I'm excited to see their first year, but as far as, like, how they build on from here. I think you just have to kind of take your lumps in the postseason and then maybe figure it out afterwards.
Yeah, you almost feel like they'd be better in the East this year. If they had to go through the East, they'd have a much easier time. The size that those top Western teams have is really going to mess them up.
Yeah, because even though Joel and Giannis are in the East, they're the sole big person on their teams, kind of.
Right.
Obviously, Brooke Lopez is on the Bucks, but he plays on the outside. He's not dominating inside like he used to. So, yeah, you're right. If the OKC was in the East, I think they'd probably be fighting with the Celtics for that, you know, best team in the East spot.
I think so, too. That was really my only big question. I just love what the Thunder are doing right now. Watching them is so much fun. And, you know, we've had a lot of criticism for SGA, especially just in the non-called offensive fouls that he loves to do with the arm push-off. Yeah. Yes. I'm so excited to see it in the playoffs, man.
I want him to prove me wrong so bad. I would love to be wrong about him, but I am going to wait and see. Ben, thank you for today. It seems like you got nothing else.
Nah, I got nothing else. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch you later. Peace.
Peace.